The stars dulled by the inferno we've created on land. Tomorrow we'll cut down the dead trees, Beau says, arms crossed and staring into the fire. How? I ask. We'll saw them down to stumps, then burn them out from the ground. How long will that take? A couple days. I feel like I've been suspended in time this last week, protected from a season that comes each year like a violent squall. In moments, I've even forgotten entirely about the world outside this little island. But I know it will find a way in. It always does. It takes 3 days to trim the 2 dead apple trees and 1 pear tree down to only stumps. And by the end of the 3rd day, my arms can barely move. They ache just lifting them through my t-shirt in the morning. We walk through the orchard, examining our hard work. Today, we will torch the 3 tree stumps. When Beau stops beside the single oak tree at the center of the grove, the one with the heart cut into the trunk, it looks like a ghost tree, white moss dripping from the limbs, 200 years of history hidden in its trunk. Maybe we should burn this one down too, he comments, surveying the limbs. It's pretty old and not that healthy. We could plant an apple tree in its place. I press my palm against the trunk, over the etched heart. No, I want to leave it. He lifts the hand to block the sun. It feels wrong to cut it down, I add. This tree meant something to someone. A gentle wind blows my ponytail across my shoulder. I doubt whoever carved that heart is still alive to care, he points out. Maybe not, but I still want to keep it. He pats the trunk of the tree. All right, it's your orchard. Beau is careful and precise before he lights the 3 dead trees on fire, making sure we have several buckets of water and a shovel at each tree in case we need to dampen the flames. He strikes a match, and instantly the 1st stump ignites. He does the same to the next 2 trees, and we watch the flames slowly work their way through the wood. The sun fades, and the flames lick upward from the tall stumps like arms reaching for the stars. I make 2 mugs of hot black tea with cardamom, then carry them down to the orchard, and we stay up to watch the fires burn through the night. The air is smoky and sweet with apples that will never bloom because these trees have reached their end. We sit on a stack of cut logs, watching the fires burn for nearly an hour. I heard your mom used to read tea leaves, Beau says, blowing on his tea to cool it. Where did you hear that? In town when I was looking for work and found the flyer. I had asked someone how to get to the island, and they thought I was looking to have my fortune read. She doesn't do it anymore. Not since my dad left. I lean forward and pull up a clump of brittle beach grass at my feet, then roll it between my palms to crush it, feeling the broken fibers before I scatter the fragments back across the ground. I have a memory of my dad walking across the island, kneeling down occasionally to pull up a gathering of dandelions or clove or moss, then rubbing them between his worn hands. He liked the way the world felt, loam and green, the earth giving up things we often ignored. I wipe the memory away with a quick closing of my eyes. It hurts to think of him, pain skipping through my chest. Do you read tea leaves? He asks with a quirk of an eyebrow. Not really. A short laugh escapes my throat. So don't get your hopes up. I won't be revealing your future anytime soon. But you can do it? Used to, but I'm out of practice. He holds out his mug for me to take. You don't fully believe in the Swan Sisters, but you believe that fortunes could be seen in tea leaves? I ask, not accepting his mug. I'm unpredictable. I smile and raise both eyebrows at him. I can't read the leaves with liquid still in the cup. You have to finish it, and then the pattern of leaves left inside is where your fortune lives. He looks down into his mug like he might be able to read his own future. Spoken like a true witch. I shake my head and smile. It's hardly witchcraft. It doesn't involve spells or potions or anything quite so intriguing. But I don't correct him. He takes a long drink of his tea and finishes it in one gulp, then extends it out to me. I hesitate. I really don't want to do this. But he's looking at me with such anticipation that I take the cup and hold it between both palms. I tilt it to one side, then the other, examining the whirl of leaves around the edges. I say, as if I were considering something important, then peek at him from the corner of my eye. He looks like he's moved closer to the edge of the log, about to fall off if I don't tell him immediately what I see. I lift my head and look at him fully. Long life, true love, piles of gold, I say, then set the mug on the log between us. One of his eyebrows lifts. He glances at the mug, then at me. I try to keep a straight face, but my lips start to tug upward. Very astute reading, he says, smiling back, then laughing. Perhaps you shouldn't make a career of reading tea leaves, he says. But I do hope you're right about my future on all accounts. Oh, I'm right, I say, still grinning. The leaves don't lie. He laughs again, and I take a sip of my own tea. Sparks dance and writhe up into the sky, and I realize how at ease I am sitting here with Beau. How normal it feels, as if this were something we do each evening, set trees on fire and laugh together in the dark. I don't feel the gnawing at the base of my skull that usually plagues me each summer, a ticking clock counting down the days until the summer solstice and the end of the swan season. Beau has distracted me from all the awful things lurking in this town, in the harbor, and in my mind. People used to say that the apples and pears that grew on the island had magical healing properties, I tell him, tilting my head back to watch the waves of smoke spiral upward like mini tornadoes. They thought they could heal ailments like a bee sting or hay fever, or even a broken heart. They would sell for twice the normal price in town. Did your family used to sell them? He asks. No. This was long before my family lived here. But if the orchards could produce edible fruit again, maybe we could sell it. By next summer, you should be able to harvest 10 to 20 pounds from each tree. It'll be a lot of work, so you'll probably need to hire more help. He says, you, like he won't be around to see it. Thank you for doing this, I say, for bringing them back to life. He nods and I touch my index finger, now wrapped with a band-aid. The stinging is gone, the cut almost healed, but it will probably leave a tiny scar. My gaze slides to Beau, to the scar beneath his left eye, and I have to ask. How did you get that? I nod to the smooth, waxy line of skin. He blinks. The scar puckering together as if he feels the pain of it again. I jumped out of a tree when I was 9, and a branch cut me open. Did you get stitches? 5. I remember it hurting like hell. Why'd you jump out of a tree? My brother dared me. For a week he had been trying to convince me that I could fly if I had enough speed. His eyes smile at the memory. I believed him. And I also probably just wanted to impress him since he was my older brother. So I jumped. He tilts his head back to look up at the sky, sewn together with stars. Maybe you didn't have enough speed, I suggest, smiling and craning my head back to look up at the stars. Probably not, but I don't think I'll test the theory again. His smile fades. My brother felt terrible. He goes on. He carried me all the way back to our house while I sobbed, and after I got stitches, he sat beside my bed and read me comics for a week, You'd think I lost a leg, he felt so guilty. He sounds like a good brother, I say.
Yeah, he was.
A breath of silence weaves between us. Sparks swirl up from the charred tree trunk into the dark. Beau clears his throat, still staring into the flames.
How long has that sailboat been sitting down by the dock?
The question surprises me. I wasn't expecting it. A few years, I guess.
Who does it belong to?
His tone is careful, as though he's unsure if he should be asking. The focus has quickly shifted from him to me, from one loss to another. I let the words tumble around inside my skull before I answer, conjuring up a past that lies dormant in my mind. My father. He waits before he speaks again, sensing that he's venturing into delicate territory.
Does it still sail?
I think so. I stare down into the mug held between my palms, absorbing its warmth.
I'd like to take it out sometime,
Beau says cautiously.
See if it still sails.
You know how to sail? His lips part open, a gentle smile, and he looks down at his feet like he's about to reveal a secret.
I spent almost every summer sailing on Lake Washington growing up.
Did you live in Seattle? I ask, hoping to narrow down the city where he's from.
Near there.
His answer is just as vague as the last time I asked,
but a much smaller town.
You realize I have more questions about you than answers. He was built to conceal secrets, his face revealing not even a hint of what's buried inside. It's both intriguing and infuriating.
I can say the same about you.
I draw my lips to one side and squeeze the mug tighter between my hands. He's right. We're deadlocked in a strange battle of secrecy. Neither of us is willing to tell the truth. Neither of us is willing to let the other one in. You can take the sailboat out if you want, I say, standing up and tucking a loose strand of hair back behind my ear. It's late. I think I'll head up to the house. The flames burning in each stump have been reduced to hot embers, slowly chewing through the last of the wood.
I'll stay up and make sure the fires are out completely.
Good night, I say, pausing to look back at him.
Night.
Chapter 8.
The orchard looks different, pruned and tidy like a manicured English garden. It reminds me of how it used to be in summers past, when ripe fruit would hang bright and vibrant beneath the sun, beckoning the birds to pick at the ones that had fallen to the ground. The air always smelled of sweet and salt, fruit and sea. In the early morning, I walk down the rows. The three burned stumps send out thin strands of smoke, even though they are now nothing but piles of ash. I wonder how late Beau stayed up, watching the last of the embers turn black. I wonder if he slept at all. I walk to his cottage and stand facing the door. I lift my fist about to knock, when the door swings open, and I suck in a startled breath.
Hey, he says reflexively.
Hi, sorry. I was just about to knock, I stammer. I came to say, good morning. A dumb explanation. I'm not even sure why I've come. His eyebrows screw into a confused line, but his lips form an easy half-grin. He's wearing a plain white shirt and jeans that sag low over his hips, and his hair is pressed to one side like he's just woken up.
I was coming out to check on the trees, he says. Make sure they didn't reignite in the last couple hours.
They're only smoldering, I tell him. I was just up there. He nods, then extends an arm to open the door wider.
You want to come inside? I can make coffee.
I step past him, feeling the warmth of the cottage fold over me. Otis and Olga are already inside, curled up on the couch as if this was their new home.
as if they now belonged to Beau. There is no fire, but the windows are all open, a warm breeze purring through the cottage. The weather has shifted, turned mild and buoyant. The air blowing in from the sea stirs up the dust motes and scares away the ghosts. Every day that he's here on the island, in the cottage, I can feel the space changing, becoming brighter. Beau stands in the kitchen, his back to me, and turns on the faucet in the sink, filling the coffee pot with water. He's tan after a week outside under the sun, and the muscles in his shoulders flex beneath the thin cotton of a shirt. "How do you like your coffee?" he asks, turning around to face me, and I quickly flick my eyes away so he doesn't catch me staring. "Black is fine."
"Good, because I don't have anything else."
I wonder if he bought coffee grounds in town before I invited him out to the island. Brought it with him in his backpack? Since I doubt there was coffee here when he moved in. A stack of books sits on the low table in front of the couch, and more books are lined up on the floor, all pulled from the shelves. I pick up a book resting on the arm of the couch. Encyclopedia, Celtic Myths and Fables, Volume 2. "What are all these?" I ask. Beau dries his hands on a kitchen towel, then walks into the living room. Otis wakes up and begins rubbing a paw over one ear. "All the books in here are about legends and folklore," he answers. I run a finger over a row of books on the bookshelf beside the fireplace. The spines are printed with titles like Native American Legends of the Northwest, How to Break an Unwanted Curse, and Witches and Warlocks, A Guide to Understanding. They are all like this. A library of books on topics of the unnatural, the mystical, similar to what's happening in Sparrow, collected by someone and stored in the cottage. But who?
"You didn't know?"
Beau asks. Coffee begins streaming into the glass pot behind him, the warm, roasted scent filling the room. I shake my head. "No, I didn't know these were in here. I had no idea." I sink down onto the couch, touching the page of a book left open on one of the cushions. "Why are you reading them?" I ask, closing the book with a thud, then setting it on the coffee table.
"I don't know. Because they're here, I guess."
Olga hops down from the couch and coils herself around Beau's leg, purring up at him, and he bends down to scratch gently behind her ear. "And what about the Swan Sisters? Do you believe in them now?" I ask.
"Not exactly, but I also don't believe people drown themselves for no reason."
"Then why are they drowning?"
"I'm not sure."
My foot taps against the floor. My heart thuds inside my ribcage. A scratching at my thoughts. So many books. All these books. Placed here. Hidden in here. "And what about the singing from the harbor? How do you explain that?"
"I can't," he answers. "But it doesn't mean it won't eventually be explained. Have you seen those rocks in Death Valley that move across the desert floor on their own? For years, people didn't understand how it happened. Some of the rocks weighed over 600 pounds, and they left trails in the sand as if they were being pushed. People thought it might be UFOs or some other bizarre cosmic event. But researchers finally discovered it's just ice. The desert floor freezes, and then strong winds slide these massive boulders across the sand. Maybe the Swan Sisters' legend is like this. The singing and the drownings just haven't been explained yet. But there's some perfectly logical reason why it happens."
The coffee pot has stopped sputtering behind him, but he makes no move to walk back into the small kitchen. "Ice?" I repeat, looking at him like I've never heard anything so absurd in my life.
"I'm just saying that maybe someday they'll discover that none of this has anything to do with three sisters who were killed 200 years ago."
"But you've seen firsthand what happens here. You saw Gregory Dunn's body in the harbor."
I saw a body. A boy who drowned. That's it.
I tighten my lips together. My fingernails dig into the fabric edge of the couch. Did you really come to Sparrow by accident? I ask, the question piercing the air between us, splitting it apart. It's been nagging me since he showed up, a needle at the very base of my neck, a question I wanted to ask but felt I shouldn't, like the answer didn't matter. But maybe it does. Maybe it matters more than anything else. There's something he's not telling me. A part of his past, or maybe his present, a thing that rests between the ribs, a purpose, a reason why he's here. I sense it. And although I don't want to push him away, I need to know. The sunlight through the window spills over half of his face, light and dark.
I already told you, he says, his voice sounding a little hurt.
But I shake my head, not believing. You didn't just come here by accident because it was the last stop on the bus. There's another reason. You're hiding something. I try to see into his eyes, into his thoughts, but he is carved by stone and brick, solid as the rocks bordering this island. His lips part, his jaw tenses. So are you. He says it quickly, like it's been on his mind for a while, and I shift uncomfortably on the couch. I can't meet his eyes. He sees the same thing in me, a chasm of secrets so deep and wide and unending that it bleeds from me like sweat. We both carry it, a mark on our skin, a brand burned into flesh from the weight of our past. Perhaps only those with similar scars can recognize it in others. The fear rimming our eyes. But if he knew the truth, what I see when I peer through Olivia Green, the creature hidden inside, if he knew the things that haunt my waking dreams, if he saw what I saw, if he saw, he'd leave this island and never come back. He'd leave this town, and I don't want to be alone on the island again. There have only ever been ghosts here, shadows of people that once were, until he arrived. I can't lose him. So I don't tell him. I stand up before our words tear apart the fragile air between us, before he demands truths I can't give. I never should have asked him why he came to Sparrow, unless I was willing to give up something of myself. Otis blinks at me from the gray cushion, stirred by my movement. I walk past Beau to the door, and for a moment I think he's going to reach out for me, to stop me. But he never actually touches me, and my heart wrenches. Spills onto the floor, seeps into the cracks between the wood boards. A burst of bright morning sun pours into the cottage when I open the door. Otis and Olga don't even attempt to follow me. But before I can pull the door closed behind me, I hear something in the distance, beyond the edges of the island. There is no wind to carry it across the water, but the stillness makes it audible. The bell at the marina in Sparrow is ringing. A second body has been found. Tavern. The Swan sisters were never ordinary, even at birth. All three were born on June 1st, exactly 1 year apart. First Marguerite, then came Aurora a year later, and Hazel the year after that. They did not share the same father, yet fate would bring them into this world on precisely the same day. Their mother had said they were destined for one another, bound by the stars to be sisters. And so, upon their birthday, during their first year in Sparrow, they closed up their shop early and strode down to the White Horse Inn and Tavern. They ordered pints and a bottle of brandy wine. The liquid was dark and red and bittersweet, and they passed it among them, drinking straight from the bottle. The men in the tavern shook their heads and whispered of the sisters' boldness. Women rarely entered the tavern, but the sisters were not like other women in town. They laughed and spilled wine onto the damp wood floor. They sang songs they had heard the fishermen bellow when heading out to sea, enticing the winds to be calm and kind. They tipped in their chairs. They toasted their mother, who they hardly remembered now, for bringing them into this world, 1 year apart from each other, but on precisely the same day. The moon shone bright over the harbor, and the whale oil lamps flickered from atop each table inside the tavern. Marguerite stood from her chair, scanning the musty room filled with fishermen and farmers and seamen who would be here for only a week or two before they set out again. She grinned, eyeing them with the heat of booze in her cheeks. "They all think we're witches," she hissed down to her sisters, waving the bottle of brandy wine around the room. The rumors had been seething through the town for months, suspicion rooting itself in the framework of homes along the seaport, passing from lips to ears until each tale became more vile than the last. The people of Sparrow had begun to hate the sisters. "Yes, witches," Aurora laughed. She tilted her head back and nearly toppled from her chair. "No, they don't," Hazel protested, frowning. But Aurora and Marguerite laughed even harder, for they knew what their youngest sister didn't want to believe, that the entire town had already decided they were witches. A coven of three sisters, come to Sparrow to unleash treachery and ill deeds. "You all think we're witches, yes?" Marguerite shouted. The men seated at the bar turned to look. The barkeep set down the bottle of whiskey in his hand. But no one answered her. "Then I hex you all," she announced, still smiling, lips ruddy from the wine. She circled a finger in the air, then pointed it at a man seated at a nearby table. "You will grow a beard made of sea snakes." She roared with laughter, then swayed her finger to a man leaning against the wall. "You will trip and fall on your way home tonight, hit your head, and see your future death." Her eyes, it would be said later, seemed alight with fire, like she was casting spells from an inferno that would burn alive anyone caught in her stare. "You will marry a mermaid," she told another man. "You will taste fish, no matter what you eat, for the rest of your life," she said to a man hunched over the bar. And as Marguerite's finger waved around the room, calling out imaginary spells, the men began to flee, certain her hexes would come true. And Aurora laughed from deep within her belly, watching her sister frighten even the toughest men in Sparrow. But Hazel, horrified by the looks on the men's faces, grabbed her sisters and dragged them from the tavern as Marguerite continued to shout nonsense into the salty night air. Once outside, the three sisters locked arms, and even Hazel laughed as they staggered up Ocean Avenue, past the docks, to the small living space they shared behind the perfumery. "You can't do that," Hazel said through her laughter. "They'll think us real witches." "They already do, my sweet sister," Aurora told her. "They just don't understand us," Hazel offered, and Marguerite kissed her on the cheek. "Believe what you want," Marguerite murmured, tilting her head to the starry sky, to the moon, which seemed to await her command. "But one day, they will come for us." They all fell silent, the wind brushing through their hair, making it weightless. "But until then, we drink." She still had the bottle of wine, and they passed it among them, letting the constellations guide them home. Later, when Arthur Helm hit his head, he swore he saw his death as Marguerite predicted. Even though he didn't actually fall on his way home from the tavern, he was struck in the jaw by his plow horse a week later. The town still believed Marguerite had caused it. And when Murray Coates married a woman with long ribbons of hair the color of wheat, people said she was once a mermaid he had caught in his fishing net, proof of Marguerite's spell coming true. 4 weeks later, on the summer solstice of 1823, a day chosen by the townspeople because a solstice was said to guarantee a witch's death, The three sisters were drowned for their accused witchery. Marguerite was the oldest at 19 on the day of her death, Aurora 18, Hazel 17. Born on the same day, died on the same day. Chapter 9. Beau appears behind me in the doorway just as the tolling bell from across the harbor begins to fade.
Another one?
He asks, hand lifted as if he could see out over the water all the way to the docks. Another one. He sidesteps around me, his shoulder grazing mine, then starts down the path. Where are you going?
Town, he answers.
You're safer here, I call after him, but he doesn't stop. I have no choice but to follow. I can't let him go alone. Marguerite is in the body of Olivia Green, and this latest kill is likely Aurora's. But I haven't seen her yet, don't know whose body she has stolen. So when Beau reaches the skiff, I climb in after him and start the motor. A cluster of boats have gathered in the harbor, just offshore from Copper's Beach. I can't see the body from this distance, but I know there must be one, newly discovered, floating, being pulled aboard one of the boats. So we motor over to the marina, Beau's face hardened against the blustery wind. We dock the skiff and see that a crowd has already assembled on Ocean Avenue, awaiting the return of the harbor police boats, cameras ready. There are signs at the top of the marina that read, "Dock members only, no tourists allowed." But there are always people who ignore the signs and tromp down to the docks anyway, especially after the bell has been rung. I push through the cloud of tourists, past the stone bench facing the harbor, when someone grabs my arm. It's Rose. Heath is standing beside her. "There's two of them," she says with shaking breath, her blue eyes magnified. She still looks pale and weak, like she hasn't yet shaken off the chill of falling into the water over a week ago, only inches from Gregory Dunn's corpse.
"Two bodies?"
Beau asks, stepping in beside me so the four of us form a tight circle on the sidewalk, our breath coming out in bursts of steamy white. Rose nods her head.
"Aurora, I think.
She's greedy and impulsive, can never decide, and so she will take two boys at once."
"That's not all," Heath says. "They saw one of the Swan sisters."
"Who did?" I ask. Heath and Rose exchange a look.
"Lon Whittemore was out on his dad's boat this morning patrolling the harbor. He and Davis decided to take shifts, like vigilantes. They thought they could catch one of the sisters in the act. Apparently, Lon was the first to spot the two bodies in the harbor. Then he saw something else. A girl swimming, her head just above the waterline. She was kicking frantically back to Copper's Beach."
Heath pauses, and it feels like time stops, all of us holding our breath. "Who did Lon see?" I press, my heartbeat rising into my throat about to burst.
"Gigi Klein,"
he answers in one swift exhale. I blink, a cold spire of ice slipping down the length of my spine.
"Who's Gigi Klein?" Beau asks.
"A girl from my school," I answer, my voice near a hush. "She was at the swan party on the beach."
"Did she go in the water?"
"I'm not sure." I glance up Ocean Avenue, where the mass of people has grown larger. Tourists press together, trying to get a better view of the docks where the bodies will be brought ashore. This is what they came for. To glimpse death. Proof that the legend of the Swan Sisters is real. "Who knows about Gigi?" I ask, looking back at Heath.
"I don't know. I saw Lon when he reached the docks and he told me what he saw. Now he and Davis are searching for her."
"Shit," I mutter. "If they find her, who knows what they'll do?" "Do you think it's true?" Rose asks. Could Gigi be one of them? Her expression seems tight and anxious. She's never fully believed in the Swan Sisters before. It scares her, I think, the idea that they could be real, that she could be taken and not even know it. It's a survival mechanism for her, and I understand why she does it. But now, the waver in her voice makes me think she's not so sure what she believes anymore. I don't know, I answer. I won't know for sure until I see her. They already found her, Heath interrupts, his cell phone in his hand, the screen lit a vibrant blue. What? I ask. Davis and Lon, they have her. His throat catches. And they're taking her to the old boathouse past Copper's Beach. Everyone's headed over there. Word is traveling fast, at least among the inner circle of Sparrow High students. I'm going down there, Heath adds, clicking off his phone. Beau nods, and Rose twines her fingers through Heath's. We're all going, apparently. Everyone will want to see if Gigi Klein, last year's homecoming princess and star cheerleader, has been inhabited by a Swan Sister. But I'm the only one who will know for sure. The harbor police boats are just starting to motor into port, carrying two bodies whose identities we don't yet know, when the four of us push through the crowds toward the edge of town. We pass Copper's Beach, then turn down a dirt road almost completely overgrown by blackberry bushes and a tangle of wind-beaten shrubs. The air smells green here, damp and sodden, even with the sunlight glaring down. No cars pass down this road. The property is abandoned. And when we emerge from the dense thicket of green, the boathouse comes into view at the edge of the waterline. The old stone walls of the structure are slowly turning brownish-green from the algae inching its way up the sides, and the wood-shingled roof is covered in a slimy layer of moss. A sheer cliff stands to the right of the boathouse, and a rocky embankment to the left. You can't see the town or the beach from here. It's completely secluded, which is why kids come here to smoke or make out or ditch classes. But it's not exactly a pleasant place to spend longer than an afternoon. As we get closer, I notice that the small door into the boathouse is ajar several inches, and voices echo out from inside. Heath is the first to step into the dark interior, and several faces turn to look at us as we shuffle in behind him. It smells worse inside. The room has a rectangle cut out of the floor near the far doors where a boat once sat, protected from the weather, and seawater laps up into the interior, making reflective patterns across the walls. The stench of fuel, fish guts, and seaweed permeates the space. Davis MacArthur's and Lon Whittemer are standing against the right side wall on the narrow 3-foot-wide walkway that stretches down either side of the boathouse. Three other girls, who I recognize from school, but whose names I can't recall, are crowded just inside the door, as if they're afraid to get too close to the water splashing up from the floor with each wave that rolls in. And sitting in a plastic lawn chair between Davis and Lon, zip ties around her wrists and a red and white checkered bandana tied over her mouth, is Gigi Klein. We seem to have walked into the middle of a discussion already unfolding, because one of the girls, wearing a bright pink parka, says, "You don't know for sure. She looks fine to me." "That's the point," Davis says, jutting out his square jaw. Davis reminds me of a slab of meat, broad and thick, with a nose like a bull. There's nothing delicate about him, or especially kind for that matter. He's a bully, and he gets away with it because of his size. "They look like everyone else," he continues, firming his glare on the pink parka girl. "She killed those two guys in the harbor. Lon saw her." "You can't keep her tied up," another girl interjects, her smooth dark hair pulled up into a ponytail, and she points to Gigi with one long, sharp finger. "We sure fucking can," Lon snaps back, while Davis scowls at the girl. Lon is wearing one of his standard Hawaiian shirts, light blue with neon yellow anchors and parrots. I feel Beau shift closer to me, like he wants to protect me from whatever is unfolding in front of us. And I wonder if he recognizes Lon from the night at the swan party, when he was wasted and Beau pushed him into the sea. There's no way to prove she did anything, Ponytail Girl points out.
Look at her fucking clothes and hair, Lon says sharply. She's soaking wet.
Maybe she... A Ponytail Girl's voice trails off. Maybe she fell in, Pink Parka Girl offers. But everyone knows that's a weak excuse, and unlikely considering the circumstances. Two boys are being hauled from the harbor as we speak, and Gigi Klein is found completely drenched. It's not hard to put the pieces together. Davis uncrosses his arms and takes a step toward the group.
She's one of them, he says coldly, his deep-set eyes unblinking. And you all know it's true.
He says it with such finality that everyone falls silent. My eyes slide over Gigi Klein, her cropped blonde hair dripping water onto the wood plank floor, eyes bloodshot like she's been crying, lips parted to accommodate the bandana stretched across her mouth and tied at the back of her head. She looks cold, miserable, terrified. But while everyone speculates as to whether she might no longer be Gigi Klein, I know the truth. I can see right through the delicate features of her face, through her tear-streaked skin, right down into her center. A pearlescent, thread-like creature resides just beneath the surface, silky, atmospheric, shifting behind her human eyes. The ghost of a girl long dead. Gigi Klein is now Aurora Swan. Her gaze circles around the room, like she's looking for someone to help her, to untie her, to speak up. But when her eyes settle on mine, I look quickly away. And now, Davis says, rolling his tongue along the inside of his lower lip, we're going to find the other two. I think of Olivia Green, now inhabited by Marguerite Swan. But she will be harder to catch. Marguerite is careful, precise, and she won't allow these boys to discover what she really is. And no sooner have I thought her name than Olivia and Lola step into the boathouse through the little door behind us. Hardly anyone takes notice of her arrival. How are we going to find them? The third girl asks, chomping on a piece of gum and speaking up for the first time. If she only knew. If all of them only knew how close they really are.
We set a trap, Lon says, grinning like he's about to crush an insect beneath the sole of his shoe. We have one of them now. The other two sisters will come for her. Gigi is our bait.
A short laugh at the back of the group breaks apart Lon's words. You think the Swan sisters would be stupid enough to fall for that? It's Marguerite who's spoken, and she rolls her eyes when everyone turns to look at her.
They're not just going to leave her here, Davis points out.
Maybe they'll think she deserves to be tied up for being dumb enough to get caught. Maybe they'll want her to learn her lesson. Marguerite stares directly at Gigi when she says it, her gaze penetrating deeply so that Aurora knows she's speaking to her, one Swan sister to another. It's a threat. Marguerite is upset that Aurora allowed herself to be captured.
I guess we'll find out, Davis says.
And until then, we don't let any girls near the boathouse.
That's not fair, Pink Parka Girl asserts. Gigi's my friend and...
And maybe you're one of them, Davis snaps, cutting her off.
That's insane, she snorts. I didn't even get in the water at the swan party.
Then we should question everyone who did.
The girl in the perfect ponytail drops her gaze to the floor. Almost everyone swam that night.
Not everyone, Lon adds. But you did.
His eyes are harpooned on her.
And so did Rose.
He nods to Rose, who is standing a half step behind me next to Heath.
This is ridiculous. Heath pipes up. You idiots can't start blaming every girl who was at the party that night. It might not have even happened at the party. The sisters might have stolen bodies later, after everyone was too wasted to remember anything, or even the next morning. Lon and Davis exchange a look, but they're obviously undeterred, because Davis says, "Everyone is a suspect, and Gigi is staying in here until we find the other two."
"She can't stay in here until the summer solstice. It's over a week away," Parka girl says, her voice pitched.
"Well, we sure as shit can't let her go," Davis rebukes. "She'll just kill someone else. Probably us for tying her up."
Davis slaps Lon against the shoulder, and Lon cringes a little, like he hadn't considered this. That he and Davis might be next on the drowning kill list for capturing a Swan sister. Gigi tries to shake her head, to make a sound, but only muffled, garbled noises manage to make it through. The bandana is tied too tightly. Gigi's parents will certainly get suspicious when she doesn't come home. The police will be called, a search party sent to look for her. But the boys did get one thing right. Gigi Klein is a Swan sister. The only problem is that they can't prove it, and I'm not about to tell them the truth. Still, this is bad. Aurora has been captured. Marguerite knows it, and the summer solstice will be here soon. Things are getting complicated. Aurora's capture has made it complicated, and I just want to stay as far away from them and this mess as I can. Keith has had enough, and I see him grab Rose's hand. "Come on," he whispers to her, then leads her out of the boathouse. A new group of three guys, one I recognize as Thor Granson, whose father owns the Ketch newspaper, and one girl shuffle in through the doorway, coming to see Gigi Klein and determine for themselves if they think she's been infected by a Swan sister. The room suddenly feels claustrophobic.
"Hell no," Davis says loudly, pointing a finger at Thor. "You better not write about this in your shitty paper, Thor, or tell your father."
Thor lifts both hands in the air in a gesture of innocence.
"I just came to see her," he says amiably. "That's it." "You're a fucking snitch and everyone knows it," Lon chimes in.
Pink Parka girl starts arguing with Davis in Thor's defense, and soon the room is a cacophony of voices, all while Gigi Klein sits tied to a chair and Olivia Green stands calmly at the back of the group, leaning against the wall. "I can't stay in here anymore. So I slip through the new group of people and stumble back out into the daylight, opening my mouth to breathe in the warm, salty air." Rose and Heath are standing a couple yards away, but Rose's arms are crossed. "They're bullies," I hear her say. "They can't do this. It's not right."
"There's nothing we can do," Heath says. "It's going to be a witch hunt, and they could just as easily lock you up in there."
"He's right," I say, and they both look up. "None of us are safe. So we just let them keep her locked up and accuse whoever they want?"
"For now," I say.
"Yeah, we do." The door to the boathouse swings open, and Beau steps out behind me, blinking away the sunlight.
"Maybe they're right," Heath offers, reaching out to touch Rose's arm.
"Maybe Gigi did drown those two boys.
Maybe she's one of them. It's better if she's in there where she can't kill anyone else." "You don't really believe that girl could be dangerous?" Beau asks, crossing his arms.
I glance over my shoulder at him, and a stillness settles over the four of us. Each of us considering how dangerous she could really be, picturing her hands around a boy's throat, her eyes wicked with revenge as she forced him below the waterline, waiting for bubbles to escape his nostrils and break at the surface. Then Rose says, "Penny?" As if she's hoping I might have an answer. As if I might know how to fix everything and make it all okay. And suddenly, I feel the urge to tell her the truth. That Gigi is indeed occupied by Aurora Swan,
and that the town is safer with her tied up inside the old boathouse. That setting a trap to catch the remaining two Swan sisters might be a smart move. But instead, I tell her, we need to be careful. Act normal. Don't give them any reason to suspect we could be one of them. But we aren't one of them, Rose says sharply. My eyes feel dry, unable to blink. Rose sounds so certain. She's so sure that she understands the world around her, that she'd be able to see something as villainous as a Swan sister if it were tucked inside of Gigi Klein. She trusts her eyes to tell her the truth. But she can't see a thing. They don't know that, I say. We shouldn't even be here. We shouldn't be anywhere near Gigi. I have a flash of a memory of Rose talking with Gigi in Sea Hall last year. They were laughing about something. I can't seem to recall what exactly. It doesn't matter. But it reminds me that they were friends once, in grade school. And perhaps Rose is more upset by what's happened because it's happening to Gigi, someone who she was once so close with. And if it can happen to Gigi, it can happen to her, or to me even. The boathouse door opens again, and several people spill out, all chatting in low voices. Lola walks out by herself, staring down at her cell phone, probably sending out more text messages about Gigi's current incarceration inside the boathouse. I want to get out of here, Rose murmurs, and Heath twines his fingers through hers and starts leading her back up the road. You're really okay just leaving that girl gagged and tied to a chair in there? Beau asks me. We don't have a choice right now. It's kidnapping and wrongful imprisonment. We could call the cops. But what if they're right? I pose. What if she's a Swan sister and just killed those two boys? Then the cops will arrest her. From the corner of my eye, I see Olivia Green finally exit the boathouse, her onyx hair shimmering in the light, her skin papery and transparent so that I can see the inhuman thing resting inside. A watery, grayish-white image that flickers and shifts, similar to an old black-and-white film, never solidifying or taking shape, always liquid, drifting elegantly but cruelly beneath the features of Olivia's face. The dark, inky eyes of Marguerite flicker out from behind Olivia's skull and settle on me. Let's go, I say to Beau, touching his forearm to urge him to follow me. We start back up the road, Rose and Heath a good distance ahead of us, already pushing through the bramble and overgrown brush. What's wrong? Beau asks, sensing my unease. But before I can answer, I hear Olivia's voice cut through the crashing waves and the cawing of seagulls circling over the tide pools on the rocky shore. Penny Talbot, she calls. I try to keep walking, but Beau stops and turns around. Olivia has already broken away from the group gathered outside the boathouse and is walking toward us. Don't stop, I hiss to Beau, but he looks at me like I'm not making any sense. He doesn't realize he's in danger just by being close to her. Leaving already? Olivia asks, coming to a stop in front of us with a hand planted smugly on her hip, nails still painted a shiny, morbid black. Marguerite has fully embraced this body. It suits her, fits her already vain, indignant personality. We've seen enough, I answer, willing Beau not to speak, not to make eye contact with Olivia or allow her to touch him. But I haven't met your new friend, she says with a vampish grin, her pale blue eyes sliding over Beau like she could devour him. I'm Olivia Green. She lies, holding out her hand. She smells like black licorice. Beau lifts his arm to shake her hand, but I grab onto his wrist just before they touch, and I pull it back down. He frowns at me, but I ignore it. We really have to go, I say, more to him than to Olivia. and I take a couple steps up the road, hoping he'll follow.
Oh, Penny, Olivia says blithely, moving forward so she's only a few inches from Beau, her eyes pouring through him. You can't keep him all to yourself on that island.
Before I can stop her, she slides her fingers up to his collarbone, holding his gaze steady on hers. And I know he has no choice. He can't look away. He's captured in her stare. She leans in close so her face is next to his, her lips hovering against his ear. I can't make out what she's saying, but she's whispering something to him. Serpentine words that can't be undone. Promises and vows, her voice twining around his heart, drawing it forth from his chest, making him want her, crave her. A need that will be planted deep inside him, that won't be satiated until he sees her again, can feel her skin against his. Her fingertips trail up his neck to his cheekbone, and a fury of emotions sparks straight down into my gut. Not just fear, but something else. Jealousy. Beau, I say sharply, grabbing his arm again, and Olivia releases him from her snare. He blinks, still watching her like she were a goddess formed of silks and sunsets and gold, like he has never seen anything so perfect or mesmerizing in his entire life. Beau, I say again, still holding on to him and trying to snap him from his reverie. When you get bored on that island, Olivia says, winking at him, when you get bored with her, come find me. Then she spins around, sauntering back to the group. She touched him. She wove words together against his ear, enticing him. She wants to make him hers for eternity, pull him into the sea and drown him. She is collecting boys. And now, she stuck her delicate, bewitching claws into Beau. Chapter 10. I start a fire in Beau's cottage. I know I shouldn't trust this feeling, this unraveling in my heart. It will only end up in a tangled heap. But I need to protect him. Watching Olivia run her fingers up his throat, touching the hard line of his jaw, a sickening lump of dread retched up from my stomach. Don't let yourself care, I recite in my mind. Boys die all too often in this town. But maybe Marguerite's words didn't work, didn't stick. Maybe he resisted. I just need to keep him safe until the summer solstice, keep him from wandering out into the sea in search of her. And then he will leave the island and this town and we'll never see each other again. Simple, uncomplicated. I stand up once the flames have ignited over the logs, sending sparks in a cyclone up the chimney. Beau is sitting on the couch, elbows on his knees, forehead pressed into his palms. What did Olivia whisper to you? I ask, sitting down beside him. He drops his hands, forehead lined with confusion. I don't know. Do you remember anything? His thumb taps against the side of his knee. I remember her. His eyes lift, staring into the fire. I don't think I want to hear what he remembers about her, but he tells me anyway. She was so close. It was like her voice was inside my head. And she was beautiful. He swallows immediately after he says it, like he can't believe his own words. I push up from the couch and cross my arms beside the fire. I can't stop thinking about her, he adds, shaking his head, squinting like he could squeeze her from his mind. But it's not that easy. That's how it works, I say, bending down to put another log on the growing flames. He stares up at me. You think she's one of them? I know you don't believe any of this, but how can you explain that you can't remember what she said to you? And that you can't stop thinking about her, that you're suddenly so captivated by her. I'm not... But his words break off. He knows I'm right. He knows his mind keeps slipping back to thoughts of Olivia Green, her fingertips against his skin.